Case number 13-7171, Yasser Abbas, appellant versus Foreign Policy Group, LLC, et al. Mr. Adelson for the appellant, Mr. Bain for the appellee.
Please the court, my name is Lou Adolphson. I represent the plaintiff in this action, Yasser Abbas, against Foreign Policy Group and Jonathan Schanzer. Your Honor, at the outset, I'd like to ask if I could have or reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, Your Honor, this case involves a very important procedural issue, which is the D.C. anti-SLAPP statute. Judge Sullivan decided the case on the anti-SLAPP statute, and he dismissed as moot the 12B6 motion of the defendants. The defendants nonetheless have argued in their brief, in fact open up their brief with the 12B6 issue. But unless Your Honors want to address that first, I think I'll go to the alien tort. I'm sorry, the anti-SLAP statute.
You can do that too if you want.
I have an alien tort case.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. The anti-SLAP statute, the issue has, of course, been addressed. And for a long time, the courts, in general, seem to just accept it as a substantive rule and something that really had nothing to do with the federal rules. And I think we see that a lot of times in the court system where something comes up and it's looked at in a certain way, but no one really delves into it. Over the last...
Before we get into the meat of the anti-SLAPP statute, can I just get an understanding of your interpretation of the intersection between the 12B6 argument and the anti-SLAPP argument, and in particular this. If the defendants say, we don't want anything more from an affirmance on 12B6 grounds than we do on anti-SLAPP grounds, then are we free to resolve the case on 12B6 grounds rather than anti-SLAPP grounds?
Well, Your Honor, we thought about that question. One of our thoughts was, well, they didn't cross appeal. It's not really before you. I think that I'm not sure why the judge didn't go further. He could have said, well, and based on what I see here, I'm dismissing it as well, because there's plenty of case law under 12B6 that he could have said, I agree with this, such as the issue of whether it's just posing questions. I think my client, from our perspective, we'd like to give you the whole case anyway. We'd like to let you see it because we think on a 12B6 motion we'd survive. I mean, this is not an opinion piece. It refers to newly emerging details. It reads as if he went and did an investigation and found out that the brothers are benefiting at the expense of ordinary Palestinians and even U.S. taxpayers.
But it's questions, right? And questions are different under the case law, especially when the questions don't have an implied assertion of fact in the question.
Well, I think they do. See, I know the cases you're referring to. We both cite them in our brief. But I think in this case, the clear implication of the article is that this is happening. It starts out talking about, if you look at the decision, the article that talks about Arab Spring.
Questions were subject to liability in circumstances like this, that would seem to put a severe chill on the ability of reporters, journalists, others to simply phrase a question before analyzing the one side and the other of the analysis and answering that question. I mean, how can just phrasing a question, is the official corrupt? How can that be?
Your Honor, I think that if you posed a question, say, in the middle of an article and you're just discussing the whole situation, that's one thing. This article starts, the brothers Abbas are the sons of the Palestinian president growing rich off their father's system. Mm-hmm. Then when you get further into it, it starts to talk about Arab Spring, how the United States is not really following their own principles, And then it says, new details are emerging of how close family members. This is not saying that this is just a question. This is saying this is a real fact. I went down and I looked at it. Then the article lays out all this stuff about the businesses, which really is just to say, look at how rich he is. And then as you get toward the end, you get back on a research trip last year. Several Palestinians on page, this page is not numbered.
I think you just started by saying that the article started by saying that they had enriched themselves at the expense of U.S. taxpayers and regular Palestinians.
Well, it says that in another part of the article.
That's the question it's posed, right?
Yes, yes. Well, they're both questions. It says, Have they enriched themselves at the expense of regular Palestinians and even U.S. taxpayers? Our position on the 12B6 aspect of it is just anybody reading that is going to say, wow, these guys are making a lot of money off of him, at least in terms of plausibility under Twombly.
Are you saying that you should prevail whether we look at it pursuant to the Anti-SLAPP Act requirement or 12B6? I mean, I sensed your argument to say you see no real difference in the application of the standards.
No, I wouldn't say that, Your Honor.
There is a piece of your argument that says that. Are you saying you should prevail under the Anti-SLAPP Act if we applied those standards correctly?
I don't think the Anti-SLAPP statute should apply, and I don't.
Well, that's not my question. Do you think you should prevail under the Anti-SLAPP Act?
I think it makes it almost impossible for us to meet that burden under the Anti-SLAPP Act.
And what is it that you think is different? Because your brief suggests it's the same standard. As distinguished from the 3M case is premised on the assumption, for example, that if they're contested facts, you still lose. That is one of the huge problems here. There is later case law that rejects that notion and suggests that if they're contested facts, you would not win under the Anti-SLAPP Act. I don't see what the contested facts are here. There's a disagreement, I think, you'll have to tell me, a disagreement over how it applies. Now, how is the standard different under the Anti-SLAPP Act? As you see it, it's faster, but how is it different? I read your brief to say it is not substantively different.
Well, the substance if we're talking substance is one thing, but let me answer it in another way, Your Honor, if I may. As a lawyer who brings complaints and who's had motions to dismiss, I would never in a million years, if I was the plaintiff, in response to a 12B6 motion, submit any material, because I would be inviting a Rule 56 motion.
Right.
So what I'm saying is the anti-SLAPP statute does precisely that. It allows the defendant to bring, in effect, a Rule 56 motion. And it's very hard for me. What else can I get? What else can I bring out in my case?
Can the defendant always bring a Rule 56 motion?
Right out of the box?
12, I move to dismiss under 12B or 56.
I haven't routinely happened.
Really?
It hasn't happened to me, Your Honor. I've seen,
maybe I'm losing it today. I thought defendants routinely did that. Okay, I've looked at it. And whichever way you want to go, Your Honor, I don't think they've stated a cause of action. And if you have an issue there, let's go to summary judgment, and they can put in whatever they want to put in.
Your Honor, in my experience where those kinds of things happen, the district court judge says, let's take some discovery. And then if you want to come back with a 12B6 motion or a Rule 56 motion, you do it. But they don't
I'm trying to figure out where you think there's a difference in the two.
Well, the difference.
For example, I'm trying to figure out what in heaven's name do we do with Shady Grove, which is strange as I read it and causes one to have headaches. But Shady Grove looks like if it mandates a different answer, the two approaches mandate the state. I don't see that here, but I'm trying to understand what you think about that.
Well, I think it does mandate a different answer because all of the material they put in talk about other instances where my client was making a public statement in response to other claims about him.
Right.
And the judge now has that. I think the judge at one point refers to him as a serial bringer of defamation claims.
And you can't respond to that under the Anti-SLAPP Act?
Well, I can respond by saying no each time he was defending himself. Okay, but I think the judge is effectively poisoned by these things and feels now that...
See, I don't understand the nature of the... I don't know if I'm being naive here. I don't understand why the poisoning is any worse than it would be when the defendant comes in with an alternative motion for dismissal for summary judgment and says all these nasty things, at least from your perspective, and you get a shot to respond as you get a shot to respond here.
I would ask the judge not to entertain the summary judgment motion. I'd say I'm entitled to discovery, Your Honor.
All right, so that's the next question. Are you suggesting that because there's only limited discovery or discretionary discovery, judge can limit you in discovery and summary judgment, too?
Yeah, but here the discovery limits are extreme. You have to show, the statute makes a reference to having to show, let me find the statute, I have it handy. It's attached to our brief. It says, when it appears likely, that word again, that targeted discovery will enable the plaintiff to defeat the motion and the discovery will not be unduly burdensome, the court may order that specified discovery be conducted. Such an order may be conditioned upon paying the expenses in responding to the discovery. This is so procedural. This is so not what the federal rules does. Judge could condition a lot of things, and maybe a judge on a 12b6 motion would say, I'm really suspicious about what you're doing. Maybe he'd do something like that. But the judge would be doing it under the federal rules, and it would be controlled. This automatically allows the judge to say, nah, you know, I don't think you're going to do it, or you're going to have to pay this, that, or
the judge can automatically, automatically is a terrible word. I think a judge in controlling summary judgment can limit discovery as she or he feels is appropriate.
I agree.
You don't have unlimited discovery.
No, I agree, but it's done pursuant to the federal rules, which have a background.
Yeah, I get that. Okay. I get that part, but that, it seems to me Shady Grove does not say that. That is, because there is a federal rule and there's some similar coverage, that's the end of the inquiry. That's not what it says.
I don't think it says that either.
Right.
But
so
I
I'm
think
trying to figure out, and this is complicated. It's not an easy case to sort that out.
I agree.
And the only thing that bothers me a lot about the 3M analysis, which, if its premise is correct, is powerful, I'm not sure the premise is correct. That is, if you have material facts that you can put in dispute, you still are going to lose. You were not asserting that. The 3M people conceded that. You did not. You agreed with the district court. That's not the anti-SLAPP law. Your assertions below, and as best I can read them here, do not buy into that. That is, if there are material facts in dispute, you do not agree that under this anti-SLAPP that you're still gone.
I think, Your Honor, that if there are material facts in dispute, we get into that issue of whether or not they're provable. And I think all of the things here would require discovery to be determined, these newly emerging facts that are supposedly out there.
The way you're trying to get into Shady Grove is to say, but we don't really have a free shot at discovery the way we would under the federal rules.
We don't.
Because otherwise I don't understand your argument.
I am trying to say that. Your Honor, it's one thing, for example, you know, there was an attorney's fee decision. The judge said they can get attorney's fees. And on the attorney's fees issue, they looked at their bill. They have 15 hours of discussion about document preservation. These newly emerging facts, there's something, I would assume, behind it. And that's what we need to get at, because we don't believe there's any truth to this.
On the discovery piece of it, is your understanding of the D.C. provisions such that it differs from the provisions that were at issue in the Ninth Circuit cases, the California provisions?
Yeah.
I do. I think this is much. This statute is really extreme, and as I understood, the Ninth Circuit didn't allow.
Right. So the Ninth Circuit draws the line between discovery, and the rest of the anti-SLAPP regime that was at issue.
Yeah. But I mean, I need discovery because in our view, on its face.
I've never heard an attorney who said I don't need discovery. That's not getting there.
So what's your explanation for why so many, the great weight of authority is against you on the Anti-SLAPP Act? You started with a statement to that effect.
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to go a little far afield. My partner over here, Dwight Stevens, and I did a case once on the contra preferentum doctrine. And if you all know that, it always says it's construed against the drafter. And if you go and really read the case law, it's a much more complicated analysis. And we have a case called Morgan Stanley versus New England that addressed that issue. We lost that one too, but we did definitely established that there was a lot more to it, and that's what I'm saying. I think this was looked at by most courts as merely involving substance, you know, changing. You know, if they wanted to make qualified immunity and say that citizens who just go and make a statement and it could be considered defamatory, and we want to give that group of people some protection, forgetting the procedural thing, which we think does violate the federal rules, that would be one thing. But this this month, the D.C. Bar Journal wrote about New York Times versus Sullivan and how important that was to the First Amendment. We're now on a complete other extreme with this anti-SLAPP statute. It is, you know, I what more would I put in my complaint? I tried to put every single fact that I had. I didn't. It's not a general allegation. We talk about everything they said, everything they responded, and our theories were laid out. I don't have any more. I can't fight an anti-SLAPP statute with all this stuff.
Okay. Thank you. We'll give you time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I intend to address both the merits and the SLAPP issues in this case, but first let me say a brief word about the merits. There's a very basic principle that's at the heart of this case, and it's a principle that was affirmed by this Court in Ullman v. Evans and by all of the other courts we cite in the brief, and that is this. Reporters have to be able to raise questions. They have to be able to raise and pose questions even when they don't have enough information to provide a definitive answer. That's a critical function of the press, and it's an essential way in which we arrive at understanding and truth.
Now, can I ask you, so that's the 12b6 question. Do you care whether you win on 12b6 grounds or anti-SLAPP grounds?
Yes, we do, because we're entitled to attorney's fees under the
right.
Anti-SLAPP Act.
But you put the 12b6 argument first in your brief.
We did.
And the reason
is because I think it colors the anti-SLAPP issue. The anti-SLAPP issue in this case is this, and it is only this. Whether there is any impediment to applying the D.C. Anti-SLAPP Act when the complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. There are a whole series of questions that can arise under the SLAPP Act under a whole different set of circumstances. The easiest case is our case, in which you can tell as a matter of law that the complaint does not state a claim as a matter of law. Now, when that is the case, is there any impediment to applying the only provision of the SLAPP Act that's any different from the federal rules, namely an attorney's fee provision? And our position is there's no impediment to applying an attorney's fee provision in our case, because the Supreme Court held in the Cohen versus Beneficial Finance case in 1949 that state attorney's fee provisions can be enforced and must be enforced in diversity cases in federal court.
So if we did what you suggest we should do in your first argument, your primary argument, which is that we affirm on 12b6 grounds, then this case goes back down. There's a fee motion that's still pending, and you'd take the position that you're entitled to fees, even though the Court of Appeals didn't address the anti-SLAPP, the applicability of anti-SLAPP.
And then we'd be back right here. So
right.
The court can affirm on 12b6 grounds, and we did not have to cross appeal because we're not seeking to enlarge the judgment.
Yeah, I think there's some force to your submission that you didn't have to cross appeal. I'm just trying to understand the practical consequences of us taking the route that you suggest we should, which is to affirm on 12b6 grounds.
This court can, if it chooses to, it has the discretion.
We'll be right back.
Duck this anti-SLAPP issue. We'll be right back a year from now. We'll rebrief it all, and we'll come back.
We're going to address it now, right?
I think it makes sense. I hate ever to ascribe intention to a judge, but Judge Sullivan is sitting on our attorney's fee motion. I think it's pretty obvious that the court is waiting to hear whether it can award attorney's fees in this case.
So on the SLAPP Act, why doesn't the Act address, to put it in Shady Grove terms, the same question as Rules 12 and 56?
Well, I think what Shady Grove and all the other cases stand for is you first have to ask the question whether there's a conflict. Of course they address the question whether the case should be dismissed, but can they stand side by side? Can you have the Anti-SLAPP Act stand side by side Rule 12b6?
And how can you do that given that there would be some cases that would not be dismissed under 12b6 but dismissed under the Anti-SLAPP Act? So they do conflict in a certain category of cases where some would go forward and some where they otherwise wouldn't.
It is conceivable that you could interpret the Anti-SLAPP Act to result in a different outcome than the federal rules in a case very much unlike this one, where the complaint does state a claim and where there are disputed facts. It's conceivable you could interpret the statute that way. However, not only did the district court reach conclusions which established as a matter of law that the complaint fails to state a claim, the district court also accepted the prevailing interpretation of these laws by saying, at page 21 of its opinion, that on an anti-SLAPP act, the standard is the same as the rule as the Rule 56 standard. The court said a plaintiff must demonstrate that the complaint is legally sufficient. This complaint fails there. And it must demonstrate that the complaint is supported by a prima facie showing of facts to sustain a favorable judgment if the evidence submitted by the plaintiff is credited. That's Rule 56. That's the standard that this judge said should be applied under the SLAPP Act. It's the standard that numerous other courts have also said
should. So you disagree with the 3M principle that the Anti-SLAPP Act would allow a disposition even where there are material facts in dispute?
I would say, if I may answer that two parts, I would say that this judge interpreted the statute differently than Judge Wilkins did in the 3M case, and we're fine with that in this case because we don't have anything remotely close to a dispute as to facts. But I would also say that if one were to interpret the SLAPP Act to impose a more rigorous standard than Rule 12b-6, it could still be sustained and applied. Why do I say that? Because if you think about it, the question really is this. If the District of Columbia or any state decides when it creates a cause of action for libel to engraft onto that cause of action certain limitations to make sure that it doesn't infringe unnecessarily on free speech, why would a federal court not allow a state or the District of Columbia to so limit the cause of action that it created? I think that is the lesson of Shady Grove. Justice Stevens says in Shady Grove, and he is the one of the 4-1-4 split, he says a federal rule cannot displace a state law that is procedural in the ordinary use of the term, but is so intertwined with a state right or remedy that it functions to define the scope of the state-created right. I dare say that's what we have here.
But that doesn't tell me whether or not D.C. and other jurisdictions meant to foreclose the resolution of material facts in dispute.
That's right. It doesn't answer that question. What it answers
is an easier case for you if you can say, contrary to 3M's assumption, no, if there are material facts in dispute, you can't continue under the Anti-SLAPP Act either. But you're not prepared to do that.
I'm perfectly happy with that interpretation of the Act. I'm trying to answer an abstract question that if you interpret it to require more, could you apply it? I'm perfectly content with that interpretation of the Act that Judge Sullivan gave and that the other courts that have upheld the application of anti-SLAPP acts have also given.
So I'm not quite understanding that because the Anti-SLAPP Act speaks in terms of likely to prevail.
Yes.
In a summary judgment proceeding, if somebody comes into court and says, well, summary judgment shouldn't be granted, well, why not? Because they're not likely to prevail. I think the court judge says, what are you talking about? You don't have to show that you're likely to prevail.
I agree with you that on its face, the Anti-SLAPP Act reads differently than Rule 56.
I say that again.
I agree that on its face, the Anti-SLAPP Act reads differently from Rule 56. Right. So, if this court were presented with a case, not this one, but a different one, in which there were material facts, you would have to decide whether or not to interpret the SLAPP Act in a way to avoid an inconsistency. And that's what a lot of courts have done. Now, I would only add this. In a libel case involving a public figure like this one, think about what the summary judgment standard is. It's whether or not there are facts sufficient to support a verdict for the plaintiff by clear and convincing proof. And that burden of proof applies at the summary judgment stage in a libel case. So how much different is that than saying, well, the plaintiff's likely to prevail? In the abstract, I suppose you could say that's a little different, but in reality, in practice, those two standards are going to result in exactly the same outcomes, I submit, because the clear and convincing burden of proof that must be applied at the summary judgment stage in a case like this, I think, forecloses a case going forward, even under Rule 56, unless there's a really significant showing of actual malice, which would enable a court to say, well, I think it's likely that the plaintiff can make that showing.
How are they going to get that without discovery?
The plaintiff here never asked for discovery because
there are... we're talking bigger concepts.
We're talking about a different case now.
I'm not saying whether it is or is not, but how are you going to do it without discovery?
You know, it's similar. The SLAPP discovery standard reads differently than the Rule 56 standard, but again, courts have interpreted these standards to mean the same thing. And the language is different. Now, in California, the courts have said, well, we're not going to apply that part of the SLAPP Act, and that's raised other questions. But I think you can easily construe the discovery standard of the SLAPP Act to mean no more than and no less than what Rule 56 says, that if a plaintiff comes into court and says, hey, wait a minute, you're asking me to prove actual malice, I need some discovery in the following ways. But let me, again...
You're asking us to read the SLAPP Act to essentially be meaningless.
Oh, it's not meaningless, believe me. The most important element of the SLAPP Act to a defendant, to the press, is the ability to recover attorney's fees when you can show that the complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, or when you can show...
except for attorney's fees. But on the on the standards, you're saying just read it so that it mirrors 12B and 56. Susceptible to that reading.
Now, if you're looking for what I really think the court should do, yes, I would say that the court should interpret it that way and say that is how we're going to read it, unless and until the D.C. Court of Appeals ever tells us differently.
Well, it seems it would have been so easy to write a set of provisions that say this is just 12 and 56, but you get fees.
Yeah.
And instead, there's this whole elaborate enterprise that's constructed. And to reconstruct that enterprise to say all that actually meant was you get fees, that's a pretty heroic reading, it seems. Or at least...
not unprecedented, but heroic.
They could have written that statute. I do think you can read this statute as essentially providing an additional defense, an immunity-type defense that requires a certain showing.
So as to that, can I ask you this question? So if a case comes up under in D.C. courts under choice of law, some other state's laws that apply, this anti-SLAPP Act provisions would still control.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I guess what I'm getting at is the anti-SLAPP Act provisions control regardless of whether it's D.C. substantive law that makes out the libel claim. So if under choice of law principles, Texas law makes out the substantive contours of liability, and it's in D.C. court, the anti-SLAPP provisions would still apply?
I'm not sure about that. And I have to go back to the statute to see what it says on that subject, but unless there's something in the statute that addresses that specifically, I don't think it's so clear at all that the D.C. Anti-SLAPP Act would apply if other substantive law applies. That's an interesting question that I'm not sure I know the answer to.
Oh, I guess I had read it to assume that it would. Against the notion that it's substantive in the way that you're describing it because it's not delimited by actual D.C. law.
I don't think there's a provision in the statute that explicitly says it applies regardless of whose state law applies to the underlying case. And I don't think it's so clear that the SLAPP Act would apply because I think there would be a pretty substantial argument that it's substantive law and therefore it doesn't apply. I think it's important to kind of – the court can go a lot of different directions in this case, and it can go down certain paths or it can avoid going down certain paths. And there's a reason why I tried to frame the issue the way I did at the outset. There is an anti-SLAPP issue that I would suggest it would be advisable for the court to entertain because it's going to come back, I believe, if the court doesn't. But the SLAPP Act issue in this case is whether there's any reason why the SLAPP Act cannot be applied when the complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. There's no question that in a case like this, the SLAPP Act and Rule 12b-6 command the same outcome. And then, because the District of Columbia has decided that in a case like this, as well as in other cases, the prevailing party, the plaintiff, but the defendant ought to be able to have its attorney's fees awarded, there's no reason why the court should not allow us to have our attorney's fees awarded, just because there's a possibility that in some other case where there's a dispute as to facts, there would be a problem with applying the SLAPP Act. Although, if I can get back to finishing the question that Judge Edwards, I think, asked me before, I would maintain that even if you think the SLAPP Act can't be construed to be consistent with Rule 56 and, in fact, imposes a stricter standard, that Judge Stevens says when there's a state law that's so intertwined with substance that it functions to define the scope of its rules, you have to apply it in a diversity case. The dissenters, the four dissenters, said, I think accurately at footnote 2, a majority of this court agrees that the federal rules should be read with moderation in diversity suits to accommodate important state interests, and if the District of Columbia thinks an important state interest is to limit the ability of plaintiffs to bring challenges to speech on matters of public interest, that this court should interpret the federal rules not to foreclose the state's specific rules designed to advance those interests. And even Justice Scalia says an ambiguous federal rule should be read to avoid substantial variations in outcome. So clearly a majority in Shady Grove, at least the dissenters plus Justice Stevens, I think would say that even if you read the SLAPP Act to mean more than Rule 56, it should be applied because there is no federal interest.
So is that another way of saying what's, I'm going to use the word preempted here, is not the whole act? Say we disagreed with you on the general proposition about the Anti-SLAPP Act, and you
disagreed with me.
Disagreed with you about Rule 12 and 56 and said those control, the different standards in the D.C. Act cannot control. But I think what you were hinting at was, but the attorney's fees provision should still be saved.
Well, it's not.
How would you do that?
It's not that the rest of it would fall. It's that when the District of Columbia law and Rule 12b-6 both require dismissal of this case because it fails to state a claim, that at the very least you should preserve that part of the SLAPP Act, not just the attorney's fee provision, but also the substantive standard that to the extent that a complaint fails to state a claim and is for that reason unlikely to succeed, the SLAPP Act applies. And you don't have to reach in this case all other possible applications of the SLAPP Act. And especially when you don't know whether the District of Columbia Court of Appeals is going to interpret that likelihood of success standard to mean Rule 56 or something different, I think you should duck that question. And I think you should answer the question whether there's any reason why a federal court should not apply the SLAPP Act when the complaint fails to state a claim, and should in those cases deny the defendant's right to attorney's fees that the District of Columbia City Council clearly intended to create.
So when you say we should duck that question, you're saying we can duck it in a way that would facilitate reducking even if the issue resurfaced after it went back down for you to get fees.
I'm saying you can duck the issues that the case doesn't raise, that you don't have to feel the need in this case to answer every issue that can arise in the wide variety of cases that can come before you under the SLAPP Act. All you have to do is ask whether there's any impediment to applying the SLAPP Act in this case.
Yeah. You're saying your argument is that the other pieces of the SLAPP Act, that is, discovery, which was not requested here, the likely to prevail standard, what it means, and material facts in dispute, whether we worry about them or not. Your argument is those things are not an issue here. We can go ahead and apply the Act because the giving of fees is not inconsistent with established law, and if these other issues come up another day, the court can decide. That's your argument.
That's exactly our argument, and in the meantime, the District of Columbia Court of Appeals might have shed light on what it thinks the likelihood of success standard means. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I definitely think the result comes out differently under the anti-SLAPP statute here. I really believe that, I said, what we put into the complaint is what we have, and we thought about it, looked at it, got as much as we had. But when you put in what is effectively a summary judgment set of papers and we don't have anything, we're definitely affected. And I want to talk about the 12b-6 because I'd be willing to hear the court out on it. As far as I'm concerned, what I know the question aspect, and there are cases like Chapin and others that talk about that, but this is really not that. This article Mr. Chandler has testified in Congress and said essentially the same kind of thing, which would be protected. But what he did here is he put in Foreign Policy magazine an article where he raises questions that clearly point to the answer. And the point of this is this is what we need discovery for and why we shouldn't be out of court. And the discovery that this statute purports to give definitely is not consistent with the federal rules.
But you didn't ask for discovery.
We did not, Your Honor, because we didn't feel we could get it. We didn't feel it would be. I meant we didn't feel the discovery we would get would be what we needed. That's what I'm saying. It talks about targeted discovery as if there was some minor point. So we would like the court to address the anti-SLAPP statute, but we'd also like the court to be aware that we feel we can stand on a 12B6 complaint. I understand it. I've been thrown out of court many times on my pleadings. And judges can make decisions that this is just a question, and it's just that there are many cases that have dealt with similar issues. But this case, in our view, is intended to make what is obviously going toward a political statement. It has something to do beyond my client. It's about his father and everything. But the line was crossed, and it became defamation when it started referring specifically to him and how he is somehow benefiting from government. And to bring it up to the 21st century, the Palestinian government is incredibly scrutinized. We all know that. There's USAID is referred to in some of the pieces here because there was some USAID money. The Norwegian government gives a lot of money. The Gulf states give a lot of money. And to suggest that he's growing rich off his father is, I think, defamatory. I think if we're required to show that he's if he's held to be a public figure, I think we'll show malice. I think that we will. But I need to be in court. I don't need to be out. I need to be here and get some discovery. And the judge, the procedure that the federal rules can do frequently, the judge will say, I'm going to give you some discovery. It's going to take 2 months, 3 months. Do it real fast and then come back with me on a 12B6 motion or a Rule 56 motion. This statute essentially precludes that. And that's why the judge felt he didn't even have to deal with the 12B6 aspect of it. He said, I can throw this case right out based on this statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.